Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With David Slack this morning. Kia ora, David. How are you?
G'day, Rachel. I'm well. How are you?
Very good, thank you. We've got some big topics to jump into. Let's start with the National Party. They've announced this campaign around better debating, I think is sort of how they're trying to pitch it, happening at the moment. What do you think is, I guess, the main takeaway from this announcement? And is it some sort of dog whistling, as it's been perhaps accused by certain groups, saying that the kind of context of debate can sometimes lead into this free speech sort of conversation that we see popping up quite a bit at the moment? What's your takeaway from this original sort of announcement?
The more I look at it, the more it gets to feel to me as though this is the hazard you run into when you hire people as your advisors who spend too much time on Twitter. Because what you've got here is a kind of preoccupation with issues that are very energetically debated on Twitter but don't necessarily resonate with a wider audience. And that would apply to quite a few aspects of the free speech debate and to the Hapuapua report and aspects of trans rights. God, I even tremble to say it because, you know, you're just bringing on a whole furious level of activity from a certain niche group when you say it. But that's the fact of it. There are a couple of people who have been hired as advisors in the National Party caucus who get really excited about this stuff and live and breathe it. And so you're now in a position where this stuff is up on billboards as though this is stuff that is vitally engaging the electorate. And I suspect that it's going to create a certain amount of bemusement and bafflement. I'm not saying that there isn't some constituency for a free speech debate and a free speech argument, albeit in a very poorly made one that proceeds from a vast array of false premises. But it's not one that's, I think, going to get traction. There's quite a lot to unpack here.
There is a lot to unpack here.
A lot of bad shit into one suitcase.
Well, one of the things I think we should probably touch on is there's been this suggestion that perhaps Don Brash has helped fund this billboard campaign that's going alongside this, particularly around Hapuapua, as you mentioned. It says Hapuapua demand the debate, and it's got Judith Collins's face. They've sprung up around the country. Now, Judith Collins has not answering questions around whether Don Brash has helped fund this campaign. Do you think this is something that, you know, first of all, should people know about where that money came from? Is it important for people to know? Why would that matter necessarily?
I don't think we necessarily live and die on it, but it's a valid question for a gallery reporter to ask, because it does kind of suggest a frame of mind. Because if you're involving Don Brash in it, you're involving somebody who is rigidly stuck in the mid-20th century with a paternalistic attitude to aspects of race relations and treaty issues in general, and a kind of a patronising attitude to tangata whenua. So there's that. That's, I think, reason enough to ask, is this the guy you're turning to help with this, and does that suggest that where you're going to be getting your help is from people who doggedly stick to an outdated frame of mind? And does that in turn mean that your party policy is going to be mired in some kind of retrograde position? And the answer to all of those questions is more than likely yes. She's being cute declining to answer the question, but it's to borrow an old expression, don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining. You know, we all know that's who's been asked to do it. We all know that he's going to his rich, bigoted mates to get the help, and that's what's going to steer this thing. And it's kind of, I think what's most telling about this is that the party wasn't there to put the money into this campaign that she fancied doing, so she had to go to this guy and his reactionary mates to fund it. And again, this takes us back to this question of positioning yourself a long, long distance from the mainstream.
This is something that has been, I guess, an ongoing conversation since we've seen a bit of instability in the leadership in the National Party in the last year. You know, there is this, you know, criticism from old members of the party, people who've left, or people who have been previously associated, that there needs to be a big culture change within National for them to get back on track as a major contender in the political sphere, in the mainstream political sphere, as you said. Do you think this is something that can happen under this particular leadership at the moment? You know, we've got Shane Areti as the deputy leader and, of course, Judith Collins as the leader. Do you think this combo is something that could get the party back on track, or is it a bigger conversation about the wider machinations of the National Party?
50% of the combo is very good, but I think he's absolutely eclipsed by the other 50%, and I don't see a way back. And really, she was a reluctant choice in the first place. There are a lot of people who saw her as too extreme, too provocative, too dogged, and all of these things are proving to be so. And you know, it's only the tyranny of the swinging door that is keeping her there. That is to say, the revolving door. You know, once that door starts revolving, there's a perception that that's all it's doing, and so your potential voters just turn away from you. And it's, what are we up to, five and 4 years? I've lost track, Rachel. But, you know, it's a real problem. It's a real problem, and I think the only way you possibly fix it without deepening that dilemma is you go back to Simon Bridges, and you've got some precedent for that. Bill English had two goes. John Howard in Australia had two goes, and his Lazarus comeback was a glorious success. That's not to say that it's inevitable or even very likely, but it's perhaps the safer way for them to do it, that you remove her, then have Simon Bridges, who is a known quantity, and then you start casting around for somebody else. But it's also a hazard of diminished caucus. You know, you just have fewer to choose from, and they are not an inspiring bunch. They're really not.
Well, let's talk a little bit. We're definitely going to be able to come back and talk about this, because I think it's going to be a long conversation here. But let's talk a little bit about what's happening currently with the travel bubble and Australia. Obviously, New South Wales is experiencing a really big surge in COVID cases at the moment. We've got a pause there. Also, Chris Hipkins has been saying that people in Melbourne and in Victoria should be anticipating the potential for a pause in that travel bubble as well, and be making plans accordingly. We're seeing a lot of discussion around the system of managed isolation and getting these mercy flights, as they're being called, for people who are stuck in quite particular circumstances over in Australia. And we're also seeing at the same time a conversation in the media about the difficulties with the managed isolation booking system. Now, these are two separate issues, but they all do kind of feed into the same conversation. What do you think is, I guess, the biggest hurdle for the government at the moment with their managed isolation system and facilities, and also with trying to manage this Australian situation that we're seeing unfold at the moment?
Well, I suppose the starting point for this is to acknowledge something that maybe doesn't get acknowledged enough, and that is to say, this is not an ideal proposition. You know, having managed isolation is a way of coping with a situation that is very difficult. There is no good option here. We're talking about the least bad one. And so unless you have a good reason to travel, a pressing reason to travel, it's a better idea if you don't, because then you don't get caught up in all of this. Now, you know, And the moment you start to say a thing like that, you get called heartless, because, you know, there are human agonies every day going on that people have to work through. But this is, albeit without bombs falling or anything like that, akin to what we had in the Second World War, where people had to adapt and wait for things to get better. And because there isn't quite that degree of trauma going on, or at least not the visible trauma. I mean, Jesus Christ, there are hundreds of thousands of deaths going on. there is a sort of a false perception that things are more or less ordinary, and God damn it, why can't I do all my ordinary things? And so that's a kind of a problem. And I think in a way, I was listening to Grant Robertson talking earlier this morning. He was being asked if they would be making any kind of adjustments because of the frustrations people are feeling, because some people are using scripts to get queue jump in the booking system. And he was saying, well, actually, no. You know, and he was more or less implying this is not an ideal arrangement, but you can't, there is not a way to make it perfect and ideal. If you did, it would mean everybody could come and go as they please, and we can't do that. So it's going to be a compromise, whatever you do. And my sense from the way he was talking was, well, we're just going to have to ride this out and get vaccinated as fast as we can. That is the crucial question, really. You know, it feels like a long way ahead. We talk about it now, but I guarantee when we're talking about this in November or December, it's going to look very different, because we're going to be talking about, I don't know, maybe 60, maybe 70% will be vaccinated by then. The proposal is that everyone will be done by the end of the year. I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to happen. I think it's more likely it'll run into the new year. But pretty great, you know. This time last year, the idea that you could have a vaccine was just a fond hope, because you knew that that was the only way through this, you know, to get out to the other side. Mm. Well, here we are. We've got one that's highly efficacious, albeit being outrun occasionally by mutations. No thanks to people like Boris Johnson for letting that stuff flourish. But I digress.
That's a digression we could go down for hours, to be honest, David.
but you know, this position we find ourselves in, all things considered, is bloody great.
Mm.
And it's just astonishing to see how querulous people can get while we make our way through to something that is a whole lot better than it could have been.
Well, unfortunately, David, that might be all we've actually got time for this morning, but I've really enjoyed the chat with you today. It's always great to have you on the show. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Take care until the next time.
Yeah. Cheers, Rachel.
Cheers, David. See you later.
You just heard a bit of political commentary
with